find out what is causing the deaths.
So you'd like me to go up to Manchester and try to figure out their language, talk to them and find out what they know about this killing thing, I said.
He's not as dumb as he looks, Gordon said.
Neither are you, I said. What you're probably looking at is an incorporeal, given the cause of death. Some sort of wraith. I can see several potential issues to this mission. The first that springs to mind is whether you're going to believe me if I say that it's not the fault of the foreign gnolls. It's possible it's something that followed them here, or they're completely unconnected. Simple coincidence. As you noted, you've had various foreigners coming over from the east. This could be part of that. The second that springs to mind is that I'm sure as hell not going on an op unarmed, and you Brits get all weeny about people being armed. The third is that assuming an incorporeal, we're not only going to have to find out what it is, but how to destroy it. The gnolls may not know that. They're not particularly into the occult, per se. They don't even have shamans.
From last to first, Fry said, nodding. Find out what it is, and we'll figure out how to destroy it. As to the second, we'll send in a support team to cover you.
Nice knowing you, gentlemen, I said, standing up. Remy will get your coats.
Look, you,
Gordon growled. Two issues, I said. First, gnolls, under the best of circumstances, are skittish. If they're being hunted, they're going to be even more skittish. One person is the best choice to make contact under those conditions. Second, the best way to protect a person is for them to protect themselves. Okay, more. I don't know the backup team, and I am probably the least trusting person you've ever met. I'd need assurance that they'll do their job if the shit hits the fan, and assurance that they're competent to do it, and you can't give me that. I'm not knocking your people, but I have a different view of what competent means, and even competence has different meanings. Are they going to follow my fire, no fire order? You'll notice I haven't thrown in the, how am I getting paid for this? I'm going to be armed for my own protection. I'm going to be either solo or with at most one other person at my back, or you'll need to find another linguist. As to my fee, I'll accept standard rates for this sort of thing. Much less than I usually get paid, I'll add. But the conditions are firm. I will be prepped for battle. Or find another linguist.
It is illegal to arm a foreign national for this sort of thing, Fry said placatingly.
It is illegal under British law to do more than half the sort of things that are your daily bread and butter, I said, sitting down. Ditto U.S. law for the MCB. Straw man argument. Gentlemen, I'm not going to go all cowboy on your turf. I don't know what sort of exaggerations you've been getting from MCB, but I am generally discreet, and when I am not, I have a damn good reason. So let's work something out. Or find another linguist.
Wait,
Gordon said, holding up a hand to Fry.
We'll work something out. As to the believability, you do know what we do for a living, right? This job is like the Mad Hatter's bloody tea party. You have to believe 10 impossible things before breakfast. So, we'll arrange to get your toys. But only for this op. No wandering around Oxford dressed for a bloody op.
Agreed, I said.
Find out what's killing people, Gordon said. We'll detach Briscoe for your backup. He's a good lad, and steady. Give him some field experience in something other than monster killing. Find out what it is. We'll probably know how to dispatch it, and Bob's your uncle.
Sure, I said, grinning. It's always that easy. The next bit was making contact with the gnolls and learning their language. I wrote the details of how to do that already in the first memoir, so I'll gloss over most of it, because the enemy was more interesting. Turned out the gnolls were from deep inside the Soviet Union. Their language was a gnollish variant of Permian, Not the geologic record, the tribal group. The Permian tribes are an offshoot of the Finnish Ugric lingual group, which is also called Uralic. In the human languages, there are about 200 phonemes shared between several tribal languages, Finnish Ugric Permian, and some with Samoyedic. Before going to visit them, I'd boned up on every known variant of Knoll and Dr. Witherspoon Bunder's seminal Knoll Dialects of the World. The man had to have no sense of smell to collect all the variants he collected, but he had missed a few. Despite claiming that it was a complete collection of all Knollish dialects with etymological tree, he'd missed pretty much every type of Knoll I'd ever dealt with. Really, it should have been entitled Knoll Dialects of England, France, Germany, and Scandinavia, with a bit of rudimentary Finnish picked up third hand. That is not everywhere that Knolls are found. Fortunately, the Finnish section had some similarity, and from there I was able to build enough of a basis to communicate. It took about a week. The Permian Knoll tribe mostly hung out around Hume Park, and Briscoe and I had many a fine adventure suiting up and clambering down into the sewers in the area. From time to time, I'd have a lorry of garbage collected to make friends and get some intelligent, for Knowles, conversation. Finally, I had the thing pieced together, and we arranged to meet up with Gordon and Fry again. "Right," I said, taking a pull on my beer. "Item the first. Not the fault of these Knowles. At least not directly. The nice thing about working with the English is, unless you're forced to go downtown, you can pretty much figure the meeting will be in a pub. The British, bless their tyrannical hearts, even have a pub in every police station. Right in there. No need to go out to get hammered. It's better than Germany that way."
"So they say," Gordon said.
"As I mentioned, trust and belief," I said. "According to them, their tribe was cursed by a Baba Yaga a long time ago. Don't ask me how long a long time is. They don't have a calendar. In the time of their forefathers, before any living Knoll in the tribe. Knoll average age is about 200, so long time. Best I got. The curse was to be haunted by some sort of specter. They leave gifts for it to keep it away. There's probably been a certain amount of pilfering of food, drink, and tobacco in the area as well. I passed on the proper propitiation to the other Knolls, so they're not going to get killed anymore. But you're either going to have to get the sewer workers to leave out some Guinness and Prince Albert along with their sandwiches, or we've got to get rid of it."
"What's it called?" Fry asked. "We're fairly good at this sort of pest control."
"You're joking, right?" I said.
"It's called Ubtapuhafak. All that means is evil night spirit. It's a previous unknown dialect of Knoll, Officer Fry. There probably is a name for it. It is probably a recognized spirit. We might be able to figure it out. But just knowing what the Knolls call it isn't much use. And it is definitely incorporeal. But that's about as much as I could get. There's not a lot of terms in their language for boogeymen."
"I hate this sort of crap," Gordon said.
"Tell me about it," I said, sighing.
"This is a Finnish-Ugric linguistic group, yes?" Briscoe said.
"Yes," I said, shrugging. "Knoll variant, but yes."
"Then will their boogeymen be Finnish-Ugric as well?"
Briscoe asked.
"Possibly," I said, frowning. "There's only one battle cry at this point, gentlemen."
"To the unseen library," Briscoe said.
"A para who enjoys research," I said, shaking my head. "Will wonders never cease?"
"A marine who can read," Briscoe replied. "Will wonders never cease?"
I had to talk the librarian into letting me leave with this, Briscoe said, slamming a heavy tome onto my desk.
"Is it me, or does he look just like an orangutan?"
"He looks just like an orangutan," I said, still grading papers.
Balding red hair, long arms, flat face. Where yet?
What?
Briscoe said. What do you have for me? There were times I still missed New Orleans. I'd more or less deputized him as my deputy. Research assistant, maybe. I had papers to grade. That sort of thing was what undergrads and junior MI4 officers were for.
Pooh, he said.
You're welcome, I said, then frowned.
You weren't saying thank you?
No, Briscoe said.
It's thank you in a rather obscure Indian language, I said. Also a type of evil night spirit of Slavic derivation.
And the master is beaten, Briscoe said.
Urolic, not Slavic. Or it was originally Urolic and got transferred to Slavic, according to this. I picked up the book and looked at the title page. Spirits, Myths, Heroes, and Devils of the Finno-Uralic Tribes. So that's saying Piru, which I'd sort of put aside as being Slavic, not Uralic, is Uralic? According to this, Briscoe said, grinning. So how do you banish it? I asked. Does it say? Briscoe said, then frowned. No. Do you know?
No, I said. We haven't covered Slavic or Uralic in incorporeal creatures, and I don't usually get into them since they're not puff applicable. Guess you've got more research coming your way.
Drat, Briscoe said, picking up the book.
I went back to grading papers. Bloody essays. Everything at Oxford was bloody essays, and of course the TAs had to grade them. And no, the students were no better at writing them than American students. I was running out of red pens.
I found a book which is said to have various spells and incantations for dispelling Slavic and Uralic spirits, Briscoe said, dropping a book on my desk again.
It was another weighty tome.
So how do we dispel it? I asked.
You could have just done notes.
I don't do runes, Briscoe said.
It seems that the Germans were having trouble with Slavic and Uralic supernatural entities going way back.
This was written in the 1100s in Germany, but it simply transcribed the Elder Futhark runes for the spells, assuming that anyone who was reading it also read Elder Futhark.
Go down to the linguistics department, I said with a sigh.
Ask Professor Fernbauer for his Elder Futhark dictionary, with my kind thanks. I'll need to bone up.
Oh, you have got to be fucking kidding me, I said, as I finished the translation. Maybe I was wrong. I'd have to get a second opinion. Was Professor Fernbauer read in?
He was.
And the translation was right. Bloody hell. This was going to be complicated, and my orals were coming up. On the other hand, the book was interesting, and this was shaping up to be a great paper. I was considering translating the whole thing, since it had dozens of wards, traps, dispellations, and charms I'd never run across anywhere else. Publish or perish had serious meaning in our job. 2 days later, I grabbed Briscoe as he was leaving class. Go down to the geology department, I said. Ask them about some sort of crystal or stone that changes color between firelight and sunlight. One color in sunlight, different color in firelight. Only found in the Ural Mountains.
If so, it'll be bloody hard to get our hands on, Briscoe said.
Worse, we'll need one the size of the last joint of a tall man's thumb, I said.
Just find out what it is.
You're not going to like this, Briscoe said. I'm not liking anything about this, I said. I'm not liking having to depend for information on 11th century alchemists, Knowles, whose language I think I'm translating right, and an undergrad para who has enough trouble with English, much less any other language.
Thanks for the vote of confidence,
Briscoe said. What am I not gonna like? I asked.
Alexandrite, Briscoe said. Extremely rare color change variant of chrysoberyl. Changes color from green in sunlight to red-purple in artificial light. Named after Tsar Alexander II. Only mined in a few areas, the northern Urals, Sri Lanka, and Brazil.
We'll need the Urals one to be sure, I said, frowning. Bit of a trick, what with that being the Soviet Union.
And a good, clear, pure quality one.
More of a trick than you would think, Briscoe said.
The Russian deposits were the finest in the world. Were being the important word. They were all mined out in the 1950s. Of the size of a large man's thumb is about 10 carats. I asked Professor Shelley how much that would cost, and he said,
Oh, about $100.
$100? I asked.
$100,000, Briscoe said.
Pounds.
Not my problem, I said, grinning. That's on MI4.
You're bloody insane, Gordon said. £100,000.
He patted his pockets for a moment.
Here, let me just pull it out of my arse, why don't I?
The night creature is a Piru, I said, or at least a Uralic version of the Piru. It's found in Slavic folklore as well. Previously, and I've checked with Dr. Henderson, there was no known way to dispel or entrap one. According to the book Briscoe turned up, there is a way using a Ural Alexandrite and a spell. The fact that they're rare is unsurprising, given that Piru are really nasty spirits. As I said, Dr. Henderson had no answer how to dispel or kill them. Generally, you do what the gnolls are doing, which is propitiate them. But if you want to dispel it, you're going to need a big Alexandrite. And it will be destroyed in the spell, so you won't even be able to sell it afterwards.
Bloody hell, there goes my budget, Gordon said. We've got the area blocked off for now. I'll have to get back to you. That really is a bit of a budget item for us at the moment.
Feel free, I said. I've got exams coming up.
That do, Gordon said, setting a large reddish-purple gem on my desk.
I'd done well on my orals. Now all I had to do was pass the written portion and turn in my thesis, and I'd have my second master's.
Pretty, I said. The stone was deeply colored, cut in an oval, and just beautiful.
Hate to ruin it. I pulled out a loop and checked to be sure. I'd followed up on pretty much everything Briscoe had brought to me, and there was a way to check if it was a Russian stone.
Bit of a budget line item. I dropped it in a pocket.
I had to call in a favor, Gordon growled.
Favor from whom, might I ask?
MR6, Gordon said. Let's just say it didn't come out of my budget. Or theirs. I had to get authorization, but it came pretty quick. Seems this beastie has gotten out of the sewers. 2 people were found dead from natural causes in the area in the last few days. Both were in the prime of their lives. And MI6 had to burn a cell. So this had better work.
I tried out some of the white incantations from the book, I said. They work well enough. Only one way to find out.
And if it doesn't, you won't have my ass to chew, if you know what I mean.
When can you get started? Gordon said.
I had exams all week. If I missed one, there went my master's. And I really needed to bone up before each of them, not to mention sleep. Death is lighter than a feather. And I could sleep when I was dead. Tonight.
You don't really need to be here, I said. The capture and destruction of a Piru takes more than just an Alexandrite. First, the Piru must be attracted and fed. They liked expensive food, drink, and drugs. Yes, drugs. Tobacco will do, but opium has much the same effect on them as on humans for some reason. We were banking on heroin for that. You could find it on various street corners in Manchester, and it wasn't like we were in danger of getting arrested. On the other hand, MI4 could just get it out of an evidence locker, which they had. We were doing the right in an alleyway off of the sanctuary, which I thought rather ironic in the circumstances. It was where the now three people had died of natural causes, one each night. You bring them in by burning tobacco and alcohol, then set up a little tableau with the various comestibles laid out. Checking the police reports, all three of the dead had been smokers, if young enough that it shouldn't have caused their deaths, and all three had been drinking. So they'd called the Piru, but hadn't offered to share. Die, humans, die. Handy tip, always be unselfish if you're being tracked by a wraith. If one shows up when you're smoking and drinking, offer them a fag and a shot. Or else.
Rather want to see what we've been chasing, Briscoe said.
We laid out a brass tray with some shots of rum, a prime cut of lamb, and a small brazier on it. Then we lit the rum and dropped pipe tobacco on the coals in the brazier. We were right by a storm drain, and it took about 15 minutes for the Piru to appear, following the scent of burning alcohol and tobacco. It was just a darker shadow amongst the shadows, a tenebrous fog rising from the storm grating. The Piru floated closer. It was difficult to see in the moonlit darkness, even with the help of the streetlights. It moved from shadow to shadow. We'd placed the tray in shadow, knowing it would avoid any sort of light. It was generally bipedal. I'm fairly sure it wasn't anything derived from human, though. You get a certain feeling around human ghosts, and this was definitely unearthly. The wraith floated to the tray and into the smoke from the tobacco and the burning essence of the rum. It was clear it was feeding in some way. Maybe it just liked the aroma. But it also made contact with the lamb. I'd gotten a tissue sample, and I intended to check the differences between the original and the sacrificed. It was pretty sure that the people who had died of natural causes had died of some sort of loss of something. Phosphate, calcium, something. It would be easier to find between the two versions of lamb. Since we were properly propitiating it, we weren't in any danger at this point, so I took notes as carefully as I could. I knew there was no way to photograph it, but I wish I could have. The rum had burned out, so Briscoe lit another shot. Give the guy credit, para or not, he wasn't fazed by an otherworldly spirit being. Once the Piru was feasting, I opened up the nickel bag of heroin and dropped that on the brazier. The result wasn't immediate. The thing wasn't moving real fast as it was, but it slowly slowed until it was simply hanging there in the smoke from the fire like a black sheet on a clothesline. I got out my cheat sheet and the irreplaceable gem. I laid the gem on the tray, in contact with some of its tendrils of shadow, and began to read. The toughest part of the whole thing had been finding the proper pronunciation for some of the Uralic and Germanic in the incantation. Dean Carruthers had put me in contact with a traditional Uralic speaker, and that had helped. Some of the words were close enough to tribal Tibetan I had to wonder if there was a racial connection. I began the incantation, calling upon the owl spirit and the moon spirit and the spirit of the gem to bind and entrap this creature of darkness. 3 repetitions and I could see it starting to sink into the stone. It also was starting to move, so I gestured at the second heroin packet and Briscoe tossed it in. Good little wizard's apprentice. It took 9 repetitions of the incantation, but finally the Piru sank into the stone completely. I picked the stone up with a pair of tongs and winced. Let's hope this works, I said, and dropped it into the brazier. Nothing happened at first, but then a sound started to emit from the stone. It was so high-pitched at first it wasn't even audible, but dogs started barking in all the flats nearby. Then it was in the audible range, for me at least, and I started to get the whole banshee cry thing. Horrible sound, eerie and painful to the ears, despite being surprisingly quiet. A bit like what a hamster would sound like if it was being slowly burned to death. At least a bizarre space hamster. Finally, with one last tortured wail, the priceless gem shattered amongst the charcoal bricks, and it was done.
"Did we get it?"
Briscoe asked. "Only way to know is if nobody dies tonight," I said. "Let's pack up. We've both got exams in the morning." Nobody died that night, nor in the subsequent weeks. A guy died of a heart attack 3 weeks afterwards in the area, but he was a risk case, so all good. The lamb samples were subsequently bent, folded, and mutilated by MI4's labs. There was a significant difference in the levels of isoleucine, an amino acid, between the two samples, notably less in the one that the Piru had touched. So, apparently, besides liking to get high, Piru's steal isoleucine. The pathologist who gave the report started to explain about isoleucine, and I asked him not to. I've got enough stuff stuffed in my head. I'll leave that to the medical professionals. Bottom line, not enough will kill you. I later went back and translated the book of incantations and traps for various Slavic and Siberian entities, as well as adding quite a few others from Europe and Eurasia. The three-book set, Identification of, Protections Against, and Traps for Supernatural Entities of the Slavic, Siberian, Balkans, and Eurasian Spirit Tribes by Dr. Oliver Chadwick Gardenier, Ph.D., C.R. Ling, is available from Oxford University Press, if you have the clearance. There's a complete copy in the MHI library as well. Now to explain why I added all that to my memoirs, besides as a commercial plug. My teacher hat is on at this point, so bear with me with the pro tip. One reason for this long explanation of tracking down one minor entity is this is the stuff you're going to have to learn at some point. You can't always depend on someone else to do your research for you. I don't mean you have to learn proto-Uralic, but you do need to learn the Dewey Decimal System. It's also about teaching. I could have taken the time to go look all this stuff up myself, but part of why Briscoe was at Oxford was to learn how to do the research. So I delegated. And that, too, is part of your job once you get past me, dumb grunt. He learned how to find some very obscure stuff in the sometimes baroque library system. For that matter, he found the tome that had exactly the right information. I might not have. Why? I knew where to look. He didn't. Sometimes sending out the person who doesn't know the right answer is the right answer. Sometimes it's not. But until that day, we didn't have an answer to Piru. We found it because Briscoe went and looked in what was basically the wrong place. Most of this particular memoir, for one reason or another, has been about the background of hunting. Everyone likes the big fight scenes, but hunting is about more. Learn the more. For God's sake, at least learn Latin and crack a book once in a while. Don't just expect me or Milo or Ray or whoever is the equivalent in your day and age to do all the work. Chapter 17. In summer, Oxford doesn't shut down completely, but it does shut down mostly. The lawsuit was still wending its way through court, and I was still persona non grata in U.S. hunting. So I took a few trips to work toward my doctorate. There was no new information about the potential Mava Penalva A beneath New Orleans. I'd done all the research I could at Oxford. It was time to sally forth. I started in the U.S., specifically in the Everglades. There was a known group of swamp apes in the Everglades, and nobody knew how to communicate with them. Time to change that. As I drove through the endless mass of sawgrass on an airboat, I noted that I really should have done this in winter. Summer in England is a charm. Summer in South Florida was killing me. I was back in the heat and hating every moment of it. My guide was an old Seminole who spoke barely passable English. I'd book-studied Seminole in preparation, and he spent most of the ride yelling corrections to my accent. Finally, we reached the cluster of hammocks where the swamp apes were reported to have been sighted. He dropped me off fast and took off. He clearly thought I was an idiot for going anywhere near them. Florida swamp apes are not Pacific herbalists like the Sasquatch. They were omnivorous and were known to have attacked and rumored to have eaten humans. But I wasn't worried about being eaten by swamp apes. They were going to have to fight the mosquitoes. I found a clearing to set up camp, sprayed on some more off, laid out the tasty viands I'd brought to propitiate the hostile cryptids, sprayed on some more off, inflated the boat I was going to use to get from one hummock to the other, sprayed on some more off, drank some water, cursed the heat, sprayed on some more off, and finally just got in my tent, despite it being, if anything, hotter inside, and sprayed insect killer all over to kill the mosquitoes that followed me in. Then I shot a spider so big, I swear to God it should have been puff applicable. Christ, I hate the tropics and subtropics. Those idiots who think exploring jungles are fun are fucking nuts. I had a mantra, though, to keep up my spirits. Doctorate, 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 doctorate. The fuckers attacked in the middle of the night. The first inkling I had was when my tent collapsed. Then the hooting started, and I was punched through the tent material so hard I was sure I was fighting trolls. Gah, gah, I yelled, hoping that some Sasquatch remained in their language. Other than that, I just balled up and took it. Gah, gah, oomph, oomph. Friend, friend, good, good. Then I tried some Louisiana swamp apes, since they were closer. Yut, yut. Whatever was pounding me stopped attacking.
You?
It said in a querying tone.
You?
I said back.
Oomph?
There was a rustle, and they were gone. It took a few weeks for me to finally make real contact. Weeks of moving from hummock to hummock, swatting insects, avoiding alligators and rattlesnakes and giant spiders. In a couple of cases, actually puff-applicable giant spiders. They were smaller tribes, I'm pretty sure fairly inbred, smaller in stature, meaner, and much devolved from the noble Sasquatch. The language was much devolved as well. Forget phonemes. There were barely 200 words in the language, and 16 related to mosquitoes. For one thing, they were a primary food source, as well as a scourge. The swamp apes picked them off each other and ate them as they were foraging. And aggressive? Jesus. They make chimpanzees look tame. I figured out the beta posture pretty quick and spent most of my time learning their language at arm's length. Territorial as hell. The family groups even got into it frequently and viciously. Fortunately, they weren't quite as strong as chimps, and I eventually got a reputation as someone who could hit back. Hard. Not quite the way you're supposed to do cryptoanthropology, but after watching one family group rip an alligator to pieces for lunch, I wasn't taking any chances. I spent most of June among those fucking monsters, and it was the worst June of my life. I can understand them being off the puff table, but it's a near-run thing. Doesn't really matter. Between inbreeding and habitat loss,
They're pretty much going to be extinct in short order. I'm not going to sweat it. I flew back to England, wrote up my notes, and then headed to Canada.
Why Canada?
There were, and are, Laurentian Yeti. Shorter, darker, and squatter than Sasquatch, they are frequently mistaken for brown bears. They're also more aggressive, similar to swamp apes. But at this point I had pretty good contact techniques, and was able to make contact more smoothly than in Florida. The bugs were nearly as bad as Florida's, but at least it was cooler. In fact, one night it snowed. Blessed relief. The language was even more removed from Sasquatch than swamp ape, yet richer. Many more nouns, some fairly complex verbs, several adjectives that were more related to Inuit, with whom they must have made contact in the past. They even had cursing, which neither other group had developed. Three of their curses, though, had an etymology that escaped me until I was on my way out, and the Quebecois guide dropped a heavy pack on his foot. Ah, etymology accepted. June in Florida, July in the Laurentians. Better than Florida. Now it was off to Nepal, where I hoped to make contact with true Yeti. I didn't climb Everest, but I went there to see where Sir Edmund Hillary and Shaman Tenzing Norgay defeated the Gorhali snow demon. Why did they climb Everest? Because it was there. The snow demon, that is. It had been using Everest as a safe redoubt, only going lower to steal children to eat. I did make contact with the Yeti. They were even more shy than the Sasquatch, but I had Hillary's book to fall back on, and I was really just verifying the data. Most of it held out. I think either Nepalese Yeti were less developed than Tibetan, or he'd exaggerated a bit. They weren't nearly as insightful as he'd described. I'd put them as less developed than Laurentian, but most of his information held true, and at least the dictionary was more or less on. I got a full plate back tattoo in Kathmandu from an old man whose family had been doing tattoos back to prehistory. All freehand, no pre-drawing, all hammered. Absolutely beautiful depiction of the wheel. He was also a shaman, and the tattoo was supposed to be a ward against scryings. If it actually worked, maybe the MCB wouldn't be able to make up any more bullshit readings about me. The Yeti wasn't the only thing that brought me to Tibet. While I was there, I tried to track down more original scrolls with information about the Mava. I did not have many contacts there, but Rigby had given me directions to a few obscure mountain monasteries. There were a few things there of use. Most of the description of the Mava was, as noted, extremely euphemistic, and the sheer horror of the sight of the thing translated clearly, despite being second or third hand, and in Tibetan. And much of it I initially took to be so euphemistic as to be useless. Of a multitude of that which is used in the airiest places. I mean, what the hell does something like that mean? But one phrase kept cropping up. Of like unto the crown of the most perfect. Crown could mean many things. It could mean brow, top of the head, since the lamas of that period shaved their heads, presumably bald. It could also mean the hat they wore. It could mean what most people take as a crown. I had no idea. My lucky break came in an unexpected form. While I was studying at the monastery, a monk arrived and presented me with a note and a summons. Somehow, Father Pema in Crestone, Colorado, had known I would end up here eventually and sent a letter of introduction ahead. It must have been a good letter because I was invited to meet with an expert who never spoke with Westerners. I took all my notes with me to Nepal to meet with a lama in exile. The lamas of Tibet had been the lords and priests of that land from time immemorial. They were worshipped nearly as gods, but by and large maintained an ascetic lifestyle that would make most homeless in the U.S. throw up their hands in anger. Lama Kodakai had once been the abbot of a monastery housing 1,000 monks and libraries with even more thousands of scrolls,
some so ancient they were as fragile as snowflakes. Now he lived in a thin-walled, drafty hovel on the poorest edge of Kathmandu, where he ministered to the flock there, dispensing wisdom and medicinal healing and blessings. And he was probably more content. It was Lama Kota Khai who figured out the hidden meanings in my notes.
"This crown refers to the head of the most perfect of the period," he told me, nodding over my copy of a copy of a copy of the original text. "They were made in the shape of the shell of a sea creature. These shells were very prized by the people of that time, for they came from far away and were quite rare. That which is found of the airiest places is ropes, such as are used on bridges. These are the airy places."
Okay, so covered in ropes. Tentacles? Probably. But the rest?
With humility, I bowed. "There are many shells of sea creatures, most holy one. This was a sort of clam."
He pulled out a sheet of paper and sketched on it with a stick from the fire.
"There. This was the form of the body of the Mother of Serpents, according to these writings of the Apprentice of the Most Perfect."
I looked at the thing and blinked. It made no sense. Every indication I'd had was that the body of the Mavapanavae was amorphous, like its pseudopods. But this was, indeed, a clam. Sort of. Sort of a cross between a clam and a snail. A clam with tentacles? Did those even exist? Wait, what was I thinking? If this was a creation of the old ones, it wasn't even from this dimension.
"I must ask, with humility, does this indicate that the body was hard? I had been under the impression, perhaps mistaken, that it was quite soft."
"Hard," Lama Kota Khai said. "Very hard, like rock. Such is known of the sacrifice of the most perfect Tubten. Their covering is like armor. If you have such in your land, they must be expelled most quickly. They settle in and cause great havoc to all around. They summon the worst of the Guras, Mavas, and Srul. It is said that they are but the young of those who are not named. Those who are not named spread their seeds among the worlds. When the time is right, when the stars align, some hatch, and, like the butterfly or the locust, go through stages of change. In time, when the changes are complete, they become one of those of the darkest stars."
Those who are not named covered a lot of entities. Tibetans. If it's bad, we don't talk about it. But those of the darkest stars, I had to think about that one for a second. I'd heard it somewhere before. No, I'd read it somewhere before. I'd read a lot of stuff. It wasn't in English. Tibetan? No. Nepali?
Savivanda Adya Rotaraharu?
That's the Nepalese term for old ones. Great old ones. Great Cthulhu sleeps great old ones. End of the world, do not pass, go, extinction level event, great old ones. Oh, shit. It wasn't a servant. It wasn't some mindless creation. The fucking thing was a larval old one? Here? On Earth? Specifically under my house? Oh, shit. I wanted to scream at the top of my lungs, but you didn't do that around a llama. I just thanked him and left a large donation for the poor. Oh, shit. There went my property values. There wasn't much in the way of fine hotels in Kathmandu in the late 80s. I was in a flea bag with a couple of single beds, a rusty sink, barely functioning toilet, and a black and white TV. I went back to it to think and turned on the TV for background noise. So, did MCB know what a Mava really was? Generally, MCB knew more than they let on. Only if they knew there was a baby great old one, they'd probably be doing underground nuclear testing beneath New Orleans. In this case, I might have made myself the greatest living expert on Mava in the world. I probably knew more than MCB at this point. The problem was, I was on MCB's shit list. They might or might not believe me. All I really had to go on was the words of some old fucker in a saffron robe. I was not on MI4's shit list, though. They owed me for taking out that Piru. They'd probably believe me. But it wasn't like the thing was under Manchester. It was under New Orleans. I needed more proof. Hell, I wasn't sure if I was panicking. I was having a hard time believing there was a larval great old one under New Orleans. Did being larval mean it was only an old one and not a great old one? How did you get the honorific great when you were an old one? Size? Territory? How fast it melts your brain? Just how long do they remain larval? And what happens when they hatch? I was pretty sure I knew the answer to that one. More interesting question? How long do they remain larval, and how long had it been cooking? These things were a complete mystery. It was assumed they could live for millions of years. Their larval stage could be a long time, like millennia, or even eons. That is not dead, which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die. Lovecraft must have had some sort of line to the pure quill. Was it ready to hatch? What sort of sign would there be? Or did we have until the sun went cold to worry? I wasn't really watching the TV. It was just on for noise. There was only one channel that occasionally had on English programs, and it announced it was changing to a blockbuster movie. Blockbuster. Some horrid B-grade SF flick from the 1950s called It, The Terror from Beyond Space. I got up and changed the channel. In my current state of controlled terror, this I did not need. Wow. Apparently the Nepalese are really into 1950s horror flicks. The Monster Who Challenged the World is about a mollusk-like monster which lives under the Salton Sea in California and is released due to nuclear weapons testing or an earthquake or something. I was about halfway through the 2-hour run. I did some math and figured that I'd tuned in with 57 minutes to go. The Nepalese host who did comedy skits during the commercial break said the movie was from 1957. When the guy I was assuming was St. Peter had sent me back to the world of the living, he told me to watch for signs. And specifically, my sign was the number 57. Okay, God, I said, looking up. Got it. Giant mollusk creature. Bad thing. Do something. I called the airport and booked the next flight out. Time to head back to the States and see if I could scrounge up some proof that didn't involve signs from the Almighty. The in-flight movie? On the flight from New Delhi to London? Alien. Flight number? Indian Airlines, flight 257. On the flight from London to Atlanta? The Blob. Flight number? You guessed it. 1157. On the way out of the airport in New Orleans, there was a homeless guy standing there with a sign. The end is coming. But do you have a specific date? I asked him as I got in the car. Remy had previously redeployed to New Orleans and picked me up. Sir? You don't want to know. Once is coincidence. Twice is happenstance. Three times is, okay, God, I've got it. You can turn down the volume. Things are worse here than I thought, Remy. I'm really thinking about moving.
Out of New Orleans, sir.
I'm not good with this continent. If I could find another planet, we'd be moving that far. Chapter 18. There was a lot of catching up to do. I couldn't get a long-distance call to work from Nepal, but I had called Ray from New Delhi. Upon briefing him about the Mava possibly being a baby old one, he'd hit the roof. What had just been a regional problem was now an all-hands-on-deck, priority one company freakout. My meeting with the DOJ lawyer and Myers was covered previously. Why didn't I bring up the possible old one under New Orleans? Because I didn't have any proof, and it wasn't part of the agenda. If I could find something, anything solid, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. MCB needed to know. On the other hand, I could easily see them nuking the hell out of New Orleans. I'm not sure what cover they'd use for that, but I really didn't want to see my house nuked. On the other hand, old one. Larval, admittedly. We needed intelligence and proof. Since the MCB hadn't signed the settlement papers yet, I couldn't engage in monster hunting. But for research, I was the man for the job. LaGrange Seismic was a small company housed in a warehouse in Elmwood. They were the first ones in the phone book I'd been able to get an appointment with, simple as that. I just told them I was a prospective customer. The receptionist was a middle-aged lady with bottle blonde hair and otherwise indistinguishable. Chad Gardenier, I have an appointment with Mr. Smith.
Of course, Mr. Gardner, the lady said. If you could wait just a moment while I call him.
Gardenier, I thought. I might hate my name, but I hated even more when people couldn't pronounce it. Smith was medium height, brown hair and beard, heavy set.
Mr. Gardner, he said, shaking my hand.
Gardenier, not a big issue. Where can we talk? The meeting room was small, musty, and smelled of paper, ink, and dirt. Not dirty dirt, but the kind of smell you get in construction trailers and civil engineering companies. It was from all the dirt shaking that goes on and people coming in covered in the stuff. There were piles of rolled-up paper in every corner. I was pretty sure I had picked the right place. My company is interested in the potential that there might be a large anomalous object beneath New Orleans. I chose my words carefully. Now that we knew the Mava had a super hard shell with a gooey center, we had a potential way to locate it. Ray had been kicking himself for not thinking of this avenue of investigation sooner. The exact nature of why is proprietary. This object will be approximately 120 meters in length and composed of stone? I'm aware that is a very generalized term to geologists, but...
You meant the Franson anomaly?
I'm not sure. What is the Franson anomaly?
It's a big cell more or less under Bourbon Street, Smith said. It was discovered back in the late 60s when modern seismic was really starting to kick in. There was a paper done on it in the early 70s, and it even made minor news. I don't know if it's what you're looking for, because it is a little bigger.
How much bigger?
Not a lot in geological terms. About double that. It's closer to 200 meters.
Oh. That couldn't be good. That was way bigger than what the puff adjuster assumed the last one had been. What sort of work has already been done? At this point, I'm willing to pay you for your time just for a briefing.
Not really my specialty.
Smith leaned back, folded his hands over his stomach, and furrowed his brow.
It's a large carbonaceous meteor that seems to have landed more or less intact, probably during the Pleistocene era based on its depth. It's mostly known because of the issues it causes.
Issues? Like odd acoustics or something?
The guy who did most of the work on it was Neil Franson. He was one of my professors at LSU, but I really like the guy, but he sort of went crackers towards the end.
Crackers?
He insisted it was a UFO. Smith grimaced. Again, really thought he was a great guy, but
crackers.
Yeah.
What set him off?
This was after I was out of college, and I was just getting started on this gig. So I wasn't directly keeping up at the time.
As I got it, some seismographers found this anomaly, and Professor Franson got a grant to check it out. When they drilled it, they got back some samples that indicated some sort of proto-life indicators. Later, they figured out it was contamination. But Professor Franson went off about it, started saying it was proof of extraterrestrial life, which admittedly would be a big deal. That was what made it a minor news story at the time. Then he started into it was a UFO and the end of the world was coming.
Did he report that to the government?
Would you believe it if you were government?
Smith said, grinning. Then he stopped. Apparently I wasn't as poker-faced as I'd hoped.
Why are you interested in it again?
Proprietary. Is Professor Franson still at LSU?
No, he resigned. Asked, just did it. I've heard both stories.
Any idea where I can find him?
Nope.
Okay, I said, standing up. Not sure what your minimum billing is, but time is money. How much? Neil Franson, Ph.D., G.O.P.H., did not reside in Louisiana anymore, thank you for your inquiry, according to the Secretary for the Dean of Geology at LSU. No, we don't know where he resides presently. Will there be anything else? I tracked down his old colleagues. They were one and all saddened by his sudden change in demeanor. Some of his less enthusiastic colleagues were more on the order of, he was always an arrogant ass, and he just finally cracked. One of them at least had a forwarding address. He'd moved to Canada. Northern Canada. Really Northern Canada. Up by the Arctic Circle, Northern Canada. Ever heard of Yellowknife? No, me neither. Not before then. Of course, the fact that it was the capital of the Northern Territories means real geography buffs know where it is, and probably most Canadian school kids know for all of a day so they can pass the test. But regular people? Not so much. How do you get in touch with him? You either write him a letter or go visit in person. And don't expect a friendly reception. It was September by then. I was supposed to be back at Oxford. I'd written a tersely worded telex to Dr. Henderson, telling her I was going to have to extend my sabbatical due to real-world issues. Now I was going to Northern Canada to interview a crazy professor. Gotta love my job. Yellowknife was a fair-sized town, mostly 'cause it was, you know, a capital. Decent, if small, airport. Fucking weather was the pits. It was September, and there was already a blizzard on the way. Why the hell would anyone exile themselves to a place like this? Oh, yeah, the end is coming. Like you'd be safe up here. Franson lived in a cabin off of the frontier trail about 10 miles outside of Yellowknife. There was a large sign on the driveway. Do not enter. This means you, along with a heavy metal gate. The driveway went around a rock outcrop to the distantly visible cabin. Friendly fellow, I said, paying the taxi driver. It wasn't a yellow cab by any means. When I'd ask if there was a taxi that could take me out to the guy's house, a nice Inuit young lady at the ticket counter had called a cousin who picked me up in a rattletrap pickup. I'll stick around, Avik Meng said. You probably won't be long. He doesn't take too kindly to visitors. Suits them doesn't take too kindly or tells them to get the hell out. Generally tells them to get the hell out. Shooting's mostly for the bears and moose. Don't pet the moose. A moose once bit my sister. Heard it, Avik Meng said. I've got a better one. A moose once killed my cousin. Seriously, avoid the moose. Will do. I headed down the driveway. The area was low scrub and dwarf coniferous trees with multiple outcroppings of rock. The driveway more or less wandered between the outcroppings. I could see why a geologist would like the area. Why anybody else would live here was the question. The trees and scrub had been deliberately cleared in a large area around the cabin. As I walked down the driveway, a rifle poked out of an upstairs window.
Go away. I don't want any.
I slowly held my hands up over my head. No sudden moves.